today's session of Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism. It's 5:20. In attendance, I'm delighted to host Speaker Chenault, Senate President Gary Stevens, the Chair of the Trade Special Committee of the Senate, Senator McGuire, our esteemed colleague, Representative Dugan, and my colleague, Representative Dahlstrom. And today we are going to hear from World Trade Center Alaska. Greg Wolf is with us. We're going to cut some of the lights for a PowerPoint presentation. Can folks back there see what see this pretty well? And so without further ado, Greg, it's a pleasure to have you before us. Thank you. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Chairman Ramirez and Madam Chair McGuire, members of the committees. Thank you for inviting me here today and giving me the opportunity to talk about Alaska's international trade economy. In the time that we have today, I'd like to talk a bit about the size and scope of Alaska's international trade activities and provide you with a brief overview of what Alaska exports, to which markets, and why it matters. For the record, my name is Greg Wolf, and I'm the Executive Director of World Trade Center Alaska. The World Trade Center Alaska is a private, nonprofit corporation with approximately 100 member companies, individuals, and organizations that all share an interest in international business. We have two important partnerships, one with the state of Alaska and one with the U.S. Department of Commerce, to provide information and assistance to Alaskans seeking to do international business. And in Alaska, when we talk about that, we're almost always talking about exports. Alaskans that have a product or a commodity or a service that they want to export, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll advance. Okay.
Yes, sir.
I think most of you know that international trade is a big business for Alaska. For the full year ending 2008, we don't yet have the final numbers. There's a bit of a lag time in the reporting of those, but our best estimate based on the first 9 months that have come in is that the year will end up at about $3.7 billion. This represents about 10% of Alaska's gross state product. I think you know the gross state product is like the GDP of a state. It represents the value of the goods and services produced in a state in a given year. Exports represent new money into the Alaskan economy. Exports support directly and indirectly thousands of jobs across the state. And the overall result for Alaska is a stronger and more diversified economy. I mentioned that exports represent about 10% of the gross state product. When I'm talking about this today and the numbers that you'll see today, these numbers do not include the export of services from Alaska, such as construction, engineering, oil and gas field services, environmental services, those types of things, for the simple reason that the U.S. Department of Commerce doesn't yet have a way of capturing that data and being able to record it and report it. We have some estimates on how big that business is for Alaska, and I can tell you it is growing each and every year. And I'll give you some examples. But exports bring nearly $4 billion of new money into our economy. I'm not an economist, but I remember from my Econ 101 classes that when new money comes into an economic system from the outside, that's a good thing. This isn't me handing you a dollar and you handing me the same dollar back. This is new money coming into the Alaskan economy, in this case from buyers overseas. Export jobs tend to be the higher paying jobs. The U.S. Department of Commerce and the Census Bureau, besides counting people every 10 years, they do studies throughout the years, and one of them they did recently was to look at export-related jobs and the salaries and wages that those earn versus domestic jobs. And they found that that those jobs tied to or involved with international trade pay 13 to 16% more than jobs tied solely to the domestic economy. And when you look around Alaska, you can see many examples of this, that some of the higher paying jobs in the state are indeed those associated with exports.
Greg, may I interrupt you first to welcome our friend Senator French, and then unless it's going to be covered in subsequent panels, when you reach a bullet point, can you tell us what those kind of jobs are? I mean, it was like $4 billion in exports.
Sure.
Is a lot. But how much of it is oil and gas? How much of it is value added, for instance, as opposed to, you know, us being provincial, just raw products leaving the state that, you know, mm-hmm. we clock on the odometer, mm-hmm. please?
Chairman Ramos, yes, I will do that on some subsequent slides. But I will say this. It's the existence of export markets that enable some industries to be here at all or to be here in the size that they are. If you take a look at some of our industries, such as mining, virtually all of the output from mines across Alaska end up being exported. Little, if any, goes to the lower 48 states. Virtually all of it goes to markets overseas. When you look, an example would be Red Dog with zinc and lead. When you look at, up until just a few years ago, prior to their closure, the Agrium fertilizer plant on the Kenai Peninsula, 99.9% of the output of that was going to overseas markets. When you look at the seafood industry, we know that about 50% of the annual seafood caught catch in Alaska is sent to customers overseas. So what I'm suggesting is that, but not for international markets, these industries would either not be here or they would be here in a much smaller way. Coal is one more example. We don't ship any coal to the lower 48, and I doubt we will ever ship coal to Pennsylvania or Ohio. But we do ship it to Korea and now markets in Latin America. So there are jobs. These are the types of industries, and so when you're asking where are these jobs coming from, there are jobs in mining. There are jobs in the seafood industry. There are jobs in a number of other fields that are tied directly or indirectly to trade. Transportation jobs also would be included there as an indirect jobs tied to trade. Another benefit of trade is that it allows companies to become larger through expanded markets and customer base. If we think about Alaska as a market itself, it's a very, very small market with about 700,000 people. So for a company to grow in Alaska, at a certain point in the company's life cycle, they will reach a certain market share. And for them to grow beyond that, there's a couple options. One is, I guess, is to take business away from other competitors here. But for others, one of the options is to maybe expand their operations to the lower 48 states. And we've seen many Alaskan companies that have opened up offices or business operations in Washington and other states. But for others, depending on their particular product or service, it may be that the best opportunity for them is overseas. When you think of the seafood industry, for example, there are some seafood products that Americans, certain sort of specialty products that don't have large markets in the United States, but they're highly desirable, prized products overseas, in Asia, for example. So depending on the company, depending on whether it's a product or a service or a commodity or whatnot, it may be that for Alaskan companies, their best bet to grow beyond their current size is to look at markets overseas. We get asked this question a lot. How does Alaska rank in trade? And these, we'll use the full year 07 since we don't have the full year 08 yet, but it hasn't changed much. In absolute terms, at $4 billion, which is where we were in 2007, Alaska ranks 42nd among the 50 states. But when you look at what trade means to the individual citizen of Alaska on a per capita basis, what it means to me and you and the people that you represent, on a per capita basis, Alaska ranks fourth in the nation. If you look at exports as a percentage of the gross state product, Alaska ranks eighth in the nation. So that tells us that more so than people living in other states where they have other industries going for them, most states, for example, would have a large manufacturing base or would have a large agricultural base. We lack both of those. So for us, we are a trading state. We are developing our natural resources, and we are finding customers for those resources overseas. The next point I wanted to make is about foreign direct investment. This doesn't get talked about too much, but I wanted to mention it because, number one, Alaska ranks fairly high among our fellow states. Alaska ranks eighth in the nation in attracting overseas investment. This is the investment by the U.S. subsidiaries of foreign companies who have set up shop in the United States and are doing business here. So far, cumulatively, $31 billion of money from overseas companies has been invested in Alaska. Now, a good portion of that can be found up on the North Slope. Take BP. That company alone has invested over $20 billion in Alaska. But there are many other examples, Japanese companies in our seafood industries. There's British companies, not only BP, but there's also in mining and in tourism. There's Canadian companies who have not only invested, but also the Canadians are rank number one in terms of the dollars that they spend in Alaska looking for minerals and metals. If you look back over the past 20 years, read the Alaska Minerals Report, for example, you'll see they track where these exploration dollars are coming from. And typically in a given year, about 75% of them are of those dollars spent in Alaska looking for metals and minerals are from Canadian companies. So not only are they investing here, they're also spending money exploring here. Why I think this is important and why this is something that shouldn't worry us, it's something that we should embrace, is that the companies that tend to come to Alaska, the overseas companies, tend to be large multinationals. And that's good because our projects usually are large-scale projects and they need a lot of money. They need a lot of capital. And these are the companies that have that type of capital. But they bring more than that. They also tend to bring a managerial talent or people with skills that we might not have here yet. So they bring those sort of skill sets to Alaska. They sometimes bring new technologies to Alaska. But these are multinational companies who can invest anywhere in the world, and they do. So when they invest here, to me, that sends a good signal, I think. It tells us something good about Alaska. It says something positive about our business environment, that they feel they can come here and get a very good return on their invested capital. It's also, I think, a vote of confidence in our workforce. It means these companies are confident that they can either find locally the talent they need to operate their businesses, or that they feel Alaska is such a place that they can successfully recruit people to come here and work. So I think the fact that these companies have looked around the world and have chosen Alaska is a very positive statement about us as a place to do business. This is a historical chart to show you where we've been. This looks back since 1994, where our export levels have been. You'll notice that starting in 2000, 2001, we've had an increase in the value of our exports. This doesn't necessarily represent an increase in the volume of the exports. What largely you can attribute this increase to is the higher prices that Alaskans have received for what they are exporting. If you take an ounce of gold that you exported at $400 an ounce, and now today you're exporting it at $915 an ounce, without exporting even one more ounce, you've doubled the revenue that you've derived from it. So a lot of that is reflected. There has been some increase in the volume in some of our industries, but a lot of that growth there toward the right side of the chart there has to do with the increase in global prices for the commodities that we export.
Craig, may I ask you a question, please? Not enough time has passed that a lot of people across the state will say great things about Governor Murkowski. But I will. Governor Murkowski did an exceptional job of looking outside of the state and building trade. It was, I thought, one of the things he was best at. He enjoyed going to the Pacific Rim. Would you talk about the influence that a chief executive can have when they look outside of the state, and talk a little bit about the approach that Murkowski took, because that was really one of the hallmarks of his administration, one of the things that there might be a fair amount of agreement on that he did very well, which was to build Alaska's brand insofar as being an exporting a governor. Can you pause there and talk a little bit about the influence a chief executive can have?
Sure. Chairman Ramos, surely, not only Governor Murkowski, but other governors. I had the opportunity to work for two governors. I worked for Governor Hickel, who's also traditionally been a very strong proponent of international trade. He's been very active in doing so in the years when he wasn't governor, and even to this day is very active. I also had the chance to work with Governor Knowles, and he also was involved in efforts to expand our trade and to open new markets. So sure, it's very important when not only the governor of the state, but also the legislative leaders of the state take an active role in not only recognizing the importance. I think anyone would argue that $4 billion a year coming in is important. When we think of the jobs that trade supports, I don't think there's any disagreement that it's important. So I think that whoever is governor, the leadership that they can provide in bringing attention to the role that trade plays in the economy and the role that they can play during the course of their tenure as governor in helping to spearhead those efforts is very helpful. We've had a very good working relationship with Governor Palin. She's participated in a number of our events and has shown a real interest in our work and the work of trade. And we work very closely with her trade office, the Governor's Office of International Trade. They're one of our key partners, and we work with them on a regular basis. So I think that I would agree with you, Governor Murkowski, as a U.S. senator and then as our governor, was very interested in promoting Alaska's international trade economy. And I think any time that we can engage our leaders in doing so, we are well served.
Thank you. Senator McGuire.
Yeah, and just to follow up, if I might, through the chair, Greg, through the years we've worked together, and there have been various initiatives that we can sponsor at the legislative level, but looking here at the outset of 2009, what are some of the things that we as a legislature can do to help support your activities and certainly those of promoting trade and export, since you have the two World Trade Committees here today?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't come here today to make a funding request, but we do have a partnership, a longstanding partnership with the state of Alaska. As an organization, we do receive a modest grant each year to help with our efforts. We work closely not only with the state of Alaska government, but also with the U.S. federal government, the Department of Commerce. We have a relationship with them as well. Try to pool our resources. I would say that there's probably not enough of us and not enough resources between the three, the private sector and the federal government and the state government. In my opinion, I think we can always do more on trade. And I think that we've seen how trade has grown. I think we've seen very good examples where the state of Alaska has actually been a leader among the states. I'll give you one quick example. In 1965, the state of Alaska, its government leaders and its business community recognized that Japan would become an up-and-coming economy and a major trading partner in the future, and invested in opening a state trade office in Tokyo. We were the very first American state to do so. Ultimately, 47 states did the same thing, but Alaska was first. Alaska was also first in Korea in 1985. The state of Alaska opened the first trade office in Korea. Ultimately, 20 or 30 other states would follow suit. Alaska was one of the first to go into the Taiwan market in 1989 with a handful of states. And we were not the first, but we were among the first in 2002 to establish a trade representative in China. Alaska actually, in this case, has been a leader in other states. I remember when I was the state of Alaska's international trade director, it wasn't unusual to get a call from another state asking for some advice on how they could go about, you know, doing what we've done. Of course, I wasn't too helpful, but in any case, it was nice to be in a situation where, in this case at least, Alaska has been a leader. And really, when you think of it, we've had to, and it's paid off that we have. In those markets now, we have old friend status. And those of you who have spent time in Asia, I think, can appreciate the benefit of the old friend status. It means a lot, and it's helped us over the years, particularly when times are tough. When the Japanese economy declined and went through a sustained decline, some states pulled out, closed their offices. You would, I guess, describe them as kind of sunshine friends. But we found a way. We had to make cuts. We had to, you know, reduce even our presence. But we found a way to stay there and continue to help our companies. So in terms of helping the private sector of a state, Alaskan's been a real leader. I think we can be proud of that.
Greg, on that point, you're right. There's nothing better than being in the same room and shaking hands, especially if there's an objective to be realized. Were we, as two committees that do have the ability to travel, if we were to target either a particular sector of our economy that we wish to highlight and enhance its exports, or if we were to target a particular trading partner who we either have not, with whom we do not enjoy a trade relationship, or with whom we think it would be possible to enjoy a greatly enhanced trade relationship, to what sector of our potential export economy and or to which new partner would you direct us to that if we were to make a visit, we would get the biggest bang for our buck, so to speak? Mm-hmm.
Chairman Ramos, you'll see later in our presentation that we have, at the World Trade Center, we have five focused trade development programs with limited resources. We have to sort of pick and choose where we focus our efforts, all of us do, with limited budgets and limited staff. But one of those programs is what we call New Markets, New Customers. And this is one where we're trying to get a little bit ahead of the curve. And to answer the question that you're asking is, where are the next Japans for Alaska? Where are the next Koreas for Alaska? And so we've taken some initial looks at a couple markets. We're looking at India, for example. India has some similar characteristics to China. It's a completely different place, but it has some of the same characteristics of the following. It has over 1 billion people. It has a growing middle class. It has a growing economy. It needs infrastructure. It needs natural resources, like China has needed. It's got some of the similar characteristics. Right now, Alaska does very little business with India, but it's a market that we're just now starting to take a look at. Another one is Vietnam. That's a much smaller market. All markets are small compared to India and China. It's a much smaller market, but, for example, they're developing their oil and gas fields onshore and offshore. We have Alaskan companies in the service sectors that there's probably a couple who are already over there. If they're not already doing business, they're trying to figure out a way how they can. But there are opportunities there. Another market that we're looking at, we've done a fair amount of research on, again, it's a very small market but could be a lucrative one for us, is Singapore. Singapore has a couple possibilities. The one we've looked at is seafood. I think you'll know that Singapore is a small but wealthy country, has one of the highest standards of living in the world, let alone in Asia. The people there are consider themselves the seafood connoisseurs. People there are ethnically about 70% Chinese. So they just through their normal course of the day might have seafood as a component of their meal as often as three times a day, whether it's soup or a whole fish or something like that. Some of the top hotels in the world, five-star hotels, are located in Singapore. That's a good market for our high-end seafood products, arguably the finest in the world. So we're taking a look at that market. Now, that is there's not a lot of people living there compared to these other Asian markets that we just discussed. But that's another one where there's opportunities to do more, to move forward from where we are. Does that answer your question in part?
Very well. Senator Stevens would like to ask a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Greg, I appreciate you're getting to seafood. That's perks my ears up. I'm a member of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute Board of Directors and ex officio member of the legislature, and I had a chance to see a trade show in Europe. And even though we've often thought of our products, seafood products, big markets have always been in Asia, mm-hmm. but now there's enormous openings in Europe because we are one of the few producers of seafood that are sustainable, and we know that the quality is there, and we can produce it, and it's not going to damage the resource. How do you work, Greg, with an organization like ASME? They're not directly a part of your organization, but there's a good connection, I'd think.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, thank you for that question. We work when we're doing some of our work overseas. We do where it's possible and appropriate. Of course, we would want to partner with a group like ASME. I think before this meeting started, I was mentioning that we had just had its executive director Ray Ryuta come to our organization a few days ago and make a presentation just on their overseas, their international work. And I would say this, I said it then and I will say it here. I've had the privilege of actually seeing ASME in action in these markets, something that most Alaskans don't get to see. You see what they do in the lower 48 or here, but I've had the opportunity to see them in action overseas, and they're doing very good work. They're getting good results. And they're competing, as was noted. They're competing against nations. So you have the state of Alaska essentially competing against the country of Norway or the country of Chile or something to sell its fish. So the competition is tough. It's often well-funded. So they've got a a tough job to do, but I've been impressed with what we've seen them do, and we've had a chance to partner with them, and then also with our state of Alaska representatives that we have in these various markets. Of course, we partner with them too, always trying to find ways to combine resources so that we can move forward, in a more effective way than trying to go it alone. We consider them a sort of a sister organization in terms of economic development. Our focus is beyond just seafood. They're very focused on that. For us, seafood, as you'll see here in a moment, is our number one export. So, of course, we're interested in what they do, and when we can, we work with them.
Follow up, Mr. President?
Is there anything beyond seafood? That was my question, I guess. That was the beginning and the end. But you're absolutely right, Greg. I do appreciate your comment about the national competition. You know, in these trade shows, it is Alaska. It's not the United States. It's Alaska and Norway and Iceland and Spain. So we really are competing internationally as a state. Yeah. And I can say I'm really proud to see how we do compete, too.
Greg, it's really compelling, and I do want to let members know that Greg has to catch a taxi at 6:30, so we have about 45 minutes with him. On this point, let me ask you, Singapore, India, Vietnam, very quickly, how do you go about establishing not just the trade relationship, because I think we grasp that, that's a function of the market. How do you establish a trade route? How do you move Alaskan products into a country where there is not a well-defined trade route?
Chairman Ramos, when we look, I guess if I could expand your questions ever so slightly, say how do we even decide which markets to look at? First of all, we take a top-down approach. We want to make sure that it's that we have the exports that match the needs of their imports. So we look to see that if there are industries or companies in Alaska that can supply the needs of a particular country. But if I can take seafood as an example again, and mention the case of Singapore, what got us looking at that? Actually, what first stirred my interest in that was I was sitting on the deck at my condo, and I saw from the Anchorage airport, I was living on Lake Hood, and I saw a 747 cargo freighter. You're asking about the route. Here's a 747 cargo freighter operated by Singapore Air going from Anchorage to Singapore. And it got me wondering, I wonder how much Alaskan seafood is on that plane. So I started to check into it. Turns out, not much. But I thought, hey, wait a second. Here's an opportunity from what I already knew about the country. Then I see the planes are flying there every day, nonstop, over there. We can get there from here. So we can get the seafood there. Okay. So where, though? What's the niche for us? So we taking this top-down approach, the industry was seafood, the country was Singapore, and the niche that we've identified initially is the high-end hotel market, where it's a less cost-sensitive market. The customers that go in there are spending $300 or $400 a night on a hotel anyways. They're often on expense accounts. Whether the salmon fillet costs $20 or $30 is not that relevant. They're looking for the best. We can make the case that we have the best. And so we take a look at these countries to determine can our export capabilities match their import needs? Do they have the money? Can they afford what we have? Because there are countries that need what we have but can't afford it. You can have a long list of those. So we look at over a number of different factors. As for the shipping, transportation is always an issue for us. We do have fairly well-established shipping by sea and by air. Transportation is always an issue, and it's actually a greater issue in some respects within the state. Is getting, you know, we have a lot of trapped resources, stranded resources, I guess is what they're called, where they're there in world-class quantities, but we can't get to them. Usually the projects that I've seen over the years, and I've been in this 21 years, a project, what makes or breaks a project oftentimes is two things, is the transportation part of it and the energy part of it. Is there power there? Can you have power for the plant, for the mine? So those two issues in terms of new developments, can you get there from here, and can you turn on the light switch when you get there? Is there power? Those two things seem to be very fundamental to a big resource project going forward or not. But transportation is an issue, the cost of transportation both within the state and then transporting it overseas. We are actually closer to some markets, particularly in Asia, than some of our competitors. So we actually have a bit of an advantage in some cases. When people talk about the Pacific Rim, we have to remember we're part of the Pacific Rim. Those are our neighbors. So there's fairly direct shipping routes for getting our resources to market. I just wanted, before I close on this slide, I wanted to point to one year in particular, 1998. You can see it dropped off considerably from the years prior. I don't know if any of you remember why that was. And I asked this question not to give you an Asian economic history test, but that was the year, the fall of 97, the Asian economic crisis, the currency crisis there called the Asian contagion, the Asian flu, started. And it hit our markets, the markets that were important to us. It started in Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, and then it moved up north and hit Korea. We weren't doing business with those other three, but we were doing a lot of business and still are with Korea. That year, as a result of the Asian economic crisis, which started as a currency crisis, then was a stock market and real estate crisis, things were collapsing rapidly. Alaska, that impacted Alaska to the tune of $750 million. I bring this up just to remind ourselves that these places may seem far away, and it may just be a soundbite on the television or a news article, but what happens in those markets matters greatly to us here. It affects us. It affects our jobs here. It affects the health of our industries here. It affects the revenues that come into the state. When there is crisis in our key markets, it directly impacts us. So it's important for us to stay engaged and to be aware and to be a player in these markets. These are our top customers. These are our top 10 markets. And responding to Senator Stevens' point, you'll notice that there's a growing number in this top 10 of European markets. And a lot of that is driven by seafood sales to those markets. But you can see that predominantly, I think it's probably, if you added it all up, close to 70-some percent, is still focused in Asia, with Japan still our number one partner. It has been for as long as I've been involved and for as long as anyone can remember. If I'd given this presentation to you maybe 7 or 8 years ago, that percentage would have been 50%. Now it's 28%. That reflects the economic decline that Japan has suffered through. The 90s was called famously called the lost decade for them. We're wondering if it's going to be the lost two decades. This year, this decade is also not shaping up too well for them. So our business and anyone else doing business with Japan has seen a drop-off. While we've been able to grow our exports overall has been largely to the dramatic increase of our business with China. With China, 6 years ago, we were exporting about $100 million worth of Alaskan commodities. Last year, we're at $700 million. It's a sevenfold increase in a few short years. Korea has stayed a strong market for us, as has Canada. You can see there's some European component, Germany, Switzerland. Switzerland is almost all one commodity. It's precious metals.
Greg, are you concluded with this slide?
I can be.
Can you take me back to the last slide?
Sure.
And thanks. Let me ask you a question. I just was thinking in my head what you said about 1998.
Yeah.
So what you're saying about 1998 is we didn't see a drop off of 700 million because there was a lack of exports. What we saw was a drop in demand for Alaskan imports. So as I was processing that, what I thought about thinking about 2009 and 10 and 11 and 12 is, what's the maximum universe of Alaskan exports if we had them? I mean, for instance, is there a demand out there that if we could increase our exports by 50%, is there a ready demand out there to take it? Or is that, have we reached the zenith, you know, where demand and supply are meeting one another, or if we were able to produce another $1 billion in precious metals and seafood, is there a ready market out there to absorb it, or would we create excess export in the marketplace? If you could just kind of go with that as a thought, please.
Sure, Chairman Ramos. A lot of the growth that we've seen, as I mentioned, in our exports has been driven, and the higher prices has been driven by the demand of of two countries in particular, China and India. Their rapid economic growth over the past several decades, their almost insatiable hunger for natural resources. Even if we're not selling to them, even if we're not selling minerals or other commodities to India, their demand in the marketplace is pushing the price up. So we benefit from that demand, whether we're selling it to them or not. China is an active buyer of Alaska, an increasingly important one, and their demand we're actually feeling directly. We compete. We're not alone in this world with these exports and of natural resources, so we have to compete with a lot of other nations. So we will be constrained by what the market will bear, if you will. But if you buy into the global growth story, that China, there might be a hiccup here for a year or two, but that China will continue its high single or double digit growth, that India will continue its high single digit growth, that other markets, emerging markets around the world, not just in Asia, will continue to grow. We're fortunate in what we have to sell. We're not selling Gucci watches. We're actually selling the building blocks of economic development. We're selling what they need to build roads and to manufacture products, to have homes. What we sell are really the building blocks of economic development. So to the extent that countries around the world are rising out of, in some cases, poverty, where they're rising millions of people out of poverty and into the middle class, where they have more discretionary income, where their expectations as consumers is higher, where, you know, those who have been traveling to China over the years, probably Senator Stevens has seen this, where he'd go to a city in China and that there was the sort of stereotypical, a couple hundred, or a thousand bicycles at the intersection. Then it advanced to mopeds and motorcycles, and now everybody wants a car. And what does that mean? They need fuel, they need oil, they need metal, they need roads, they need bridges, they need all the things that go with having a car. People want to have their own home. They want to have their own condo or apartment or whatnot. And as they have the funds to do that, the discretionary income to do that, they can. They want to have wonderful seafood. So they want to go to a nice restaurant or stay at a nice hotel and enjoy the best. And when they hear that Alaska has the best, that's what they want to buy. So I think if the global growth story continues, we're well positioned because of where we are on the Pacific Rim, because of what we have in natural resources, the building blocks, and because of one other thing. As part of the United States, we offer something very important to a country that is relying on imported food or imported natural resources like oil or gas or anything like that. We have the political stability of being part of the United States. When you look at some of our competitors, arguably are far less stable. Some of the countries in the Middle East or other parts of the world where things are very, very unstable, where we don't know what will happen tomorrow. When you're completely reliant, Japan is completely reliant, almost 99% reliant on imported energy. Look, fortunately for us, they've been, since 1969, they've been importing LNG from Alaska over 30 years. We have proven ourselves to these markets that we are a reliable trading partner. And being part of the United States helps us in that reliability. There's not much chance of a coup or something like that occurring, and so that those supply lines can stay active.
What an upbeat presentation. Senator French has a question.
It is upbeat, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And your question, to a large degree, anticipated mine, and then I looked ahead and answered my exact question by going to a slide that told me what you expect our 2009 exports to be.
Okay.
And
can I?
Absolutely, yeah.
I'll pose the question and just okay. Sort of comment by way of saying what's on my mind, which is I expect a greater contraction of the world markets next year than your presentation anticipates. But you're the expert. I'm not. I'm here to learn, so I appreciate giving me your analysis.
Okay. Through the chair, could I delay that just for a few more slides?
Whatever
come
fits
to it?
Your
okay.
presentation the best.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, these are the countries that we export to. Some of those, for example, are sort of single commodity markets. I mentioned Switzerland. It's almost exclusively precious metals. Belgium has always been that way, too, with zinc. They have a large smelting business for Europe and for North Africa. So that's where some of our zinc has been going. It's the Asian markets, which tend to be larger, and they tend to be more multidimensional. They're taking a little bit of everything that we have. I just wanted to show this. If this could go back several more years, it would be more dramatic. But even in the past 3 years, our growth, this is January through September, the first 9 months of these 3 years, showing our continued growth with China. China is now the state's second largest trading partner. That's a position that's been held by Korea for at least 30 years. And if China continues to grow at the rate it has been growing, or even at a slightly slower rate, and if Japan's economy doesn't recover in a significant way, it's conceivable that China could become our number one partner. I wanted to say one more point about China. I think that you were going to see an evolution of our relationship with that country as a state. I think right now they're an important customer and increasingly important. But I think the next phase it will be them not only being a customer, but wanting to be a partner in the natural resource development projects here. The reason why I suspect this to be true is when I look around the world, whether it's in Canada, whether it's in Australia, whether it's in South America, whether it's in Africa, where you find natural resources in abundance, you find the Chinese and you find Chinese investment. I don't know why Alaska would be any different. We saw during the AGEA process that at least one Chinese company put in an application. I suspect in the future, whether it's for that type of project or a mineral project or some other type of project, is very likely a chance that we will see Chinese companies interested in partnering with us to develop these resources. So that to me represents sort of the next phase of the relationship. As we've done with other countries, I think we'll see it with China as well. I put this slide up. Obviously, this is a slide that's changing by the day. But this is a projection for 2009. This addresses Senator French's question to some extent. I put this on here to show a couple things. Here's where we are. This is the projection for 2009 from the International Monetary Fund. It came out a couple months ago. They're projecting that U.S. growth will decline by about 2%. So it's to the right here that you see countries that are actually still growing, albeit at lower levels than they were just a few years ago. For example, China is at 8.5. That's down from about 10 or 11. India, again, always a little bit in China's shadows in terms of this economic growth, but still 6.3%. Vietnam, Singapore, Hong Kong, Korea, that's South Korea, Australia. My point in showing this is that it could, again, coming back to where Alaskans can look for opportunity, you want to be where the market's growing, not shrinking. And if you look at a chart like this, you see that luckily where we are in some cases, we're in Korea already, we're in China already, but you see some of these other markets, maybe this is where we should be looking, and maybe this is where Alaskans will find their next opportunity, is in markets that, even with this current economic slowdown and crisis, are still growing at 3, 4, and 5%.
Greg, without having consulted with my colleague, with the Senate Chair, could we invite you back again with a strategy for these four countries, China, India, Vietnam, and Singapore, and to suggest to us trade missions or specific strategies or specific market sectors so that we could pick and choose like going to a buffet and determine where, because these two committees both have travel budgets and the opportunity is available for us to go and do something, and it might be a terrific way, a survey of these four countries and the potential markets that we could open up just with a friendly trade mission would be certainly, I think, worth a second examination. Is that going to enjoy the consent of members here? I mean, this is one of the most positive meetings I've attended in the last 3 weeks. I mean, it's just so nice to hear an upbeat story.
Thank you, Chairman Ramos and Madam Chair. I'd be happy to do that, and I will do so in consultation with our colleagues at the State of Alaska and with the U.S. Department of Commerce. These are people we work with daily, and they bring considerable expertise and resources to a strategy like this and to helping us conduct missions like this. They're our good friends and partners. But in any case, I'll just finish this slide with looking out, even in years ahead to here, the next few years that may be slow, most countries, the U.S., we would be happy to have only 2% growth or only 3% growth. We're looking at ourselves and some other countries with negative growth. So it's nice that we have a focus on some of these markets already, and it looks like this is where some of the our bigger opportunities are going to be in the next several years, is where the markets are still indeed growing. That China market, the most pessimistic analysis that I've heard was from the Royal Bank of Scotland, their economic unit. They projected 5% growth for China. That's probably the lowest one that you'll see. The Chinese government is still holding to, well, different agencies have different numbers, but it's all at least 8%. Part of that is because there's an understanding or a position held by the government there that they have to be at least at that growth rate to avoid a large unemployment problem in the country. Think of all the millions of people who are coming from the rural parts of the country, from the countryside, coming to the big cities looking for jobs. They can have jobs for them if they're growing at rates like that. When those rates slow down, then it creates some social problems. So, like I say, the most pessimistic forecast I've seen is 5%. I've seen some, I guess, maybe overly optimistic projections of still 9 or 10%. Probably what we're projecting in terms of our own use is somewhere in a 7 or 8%. And again, we may be a little bit optimistic, but we're hoping that's where it stays. Those are our markets. What do we sell our customers? As we were discussing earlier with Senator Stevens, seafood has been and remains our single largest export commodity at over 50%. Minerals, and this is primarily zinc and lead that make up this category, is our second largest. Energy is sort of a combined category that includes LNG exports, coal, and from time to time, refined fuel products from our refineries, products like naphtha, for example, that are exported to customers in Canada and elsewhere. So the energy component there is no, I think everyone here knows, we do not export any crude oil overseas, and we have not for a number of years. Historically, we have small quantities, but currently we do not. Yes, sorry, Mr. Chairman.
On that point, we just went out to the Red Dog Mine over the weekend, the House Energy Committee. They talked about how we don't have a smelting plant, although we possibly could at ADAC. And so if we were to see that that pie chart redrawn, and the distinction was value added versus raw product, what percentage of those aggregated items would be value added, and which of those categories would be dominant in value added?
Mr. Chairman, I wish I could answer that in a more positive way than I will. Most of that is not does not. Most of that is essentially the raw commodity or the unprocessed commodity. That's where we have a lot of work to do in capturing more of that value here. Whether it's an ounce of gold, if today's gold price is $915, we'll never get more than $915 for that ounce. If we turn it into a necklace, we can get a couple thousand for it. That's just a very simple example. But our ability to do more with what we have, we will always get, essentially the lowest price in that commodities food chain when we don't add any value to it. There have been successful examples of value added. For example, when we were doing the fertilizer exports, that was a great example and brought in hundreds of millions of dollars every year. I think the last year there was about $300 million, where they took a raw commodity, in that case gas, and turned it into urea and ammonia, ammonia-related fertilizer products. Another case would be, I guess, the LNG is a way of adding value, taking the gas and converting it into LNG and shipping it is another case. But by and large, what you see here, it represents raw commodities, which means that we're not capturing anywhere near what we should, in my opinion, of the value of that, of the ultimate value of that export. Someone else, somewhere along the line, is capturing those jobs and those additional revenues.
Greg, Senator French has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be a question that leads into a presentation that we take up at a later date. But when I first ran for office in 2000, you had to talk about value-added industries. It was just one of the concepts that was in the political landscape, and it was all about getting us away from oil and onto a more diversified economy. And when oil prices ran up, we stopped talking about that and went back to our base, if you will. And I guess my question is, give me an example of a specific governmental policy that would help us diversify our economy and encourage value-added industries here in Alaska. And I guess the one big caveat that I would add as a footnote to my question is the Alaska seafood plant is in my district, and I went and ran at their track over the weekend, but it's not a seafood plant anymore, it's a church. And it's a wildly successful church, but it isn't generating the state of Alaska much money. So that's my question. If you have any thoughts about it now, great. If you want to wait until a future hearing, I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Senator French. Yeah, I would like to address that perhaps at a future presentation. I'm familiar with the one example that you mentioned. One of the things, though, that for any value-added project here in Alaska, as I mentioned at the outset, Alaska itself is a very small market. Whether you're trying to produce bottled water or value-added seafood or fertilizer or any of these other things, Alaska itself will never be the main customer for that. We just don't have enough people here. Our total population is a suburb of many major cities, even in the lower 48. So for the projects to pencil out and to make sense and to be viable, they're going to have customers outside of Alaska. There's only two options there, the lower 48 markets or the overseas markets. And as I mentioned earlier, in some cases, it will be that they will find their customers overseas. That was the case of Agrium. Agrium had a couple hundred high-paying jobs on the Kenai Peninsula. Average wage was about $80,000 per job. They're all gone now. But none of that product was exported to the lower 48. It all went overseas. And when you look at things like I mentioned coal and whatnot, those types of exports, really it's going to be the overseas markets that make that possible. I will, at a future occasion, if you invite me back, I'll address that in more detail.
You're invited. Senator McGuire.
Any way to track intellectual property or any effort that you've made to do so?
Madam Chair McGuire, what we are attempting to track is the export of services, and some of those service companies are driven by their intellectual property. They have proprietary software, for example, or some proprietary hardware. And I got a couple examples here on an upcoming slide that talk about that. Again, it's very hard to track, just because when you export a commodity, there are documents that you fill in, which are pretty simple. You know, what is it? How much does it weigh? What's its value? Who's it's going to? You can track it easily. When someone gets an engineer gets a job over in Sakhalin to design something, we usually only hear about it anecdotally. Either they tell us, they announce it themselves, it's in an annual report, or we just happen to be working with them. So there isn't a way to really capture it that well. There are a number of Alaskan companies, though, that do have proprietary software. They have got patents on products that they've developed here, or they have software which they've developed. But it still represents a small portion of the economy. It's where we can grow, because it's where you can do that work from almost anywhere. You could be here, or you could be in North Carolina, or you could be in Silicon Valley. You could just as easily be here in the Silicon Tundra and do it here.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you. And if I can just follow up, if that, as you look forward to this next year and the coming year, it would be interesting to see if you could look at a model for it, because it's one of the things in the renewable energy area that we're looking at with tax incentives and credits and things, is that there will probably be a lot more intellectual property that comes out of that field. And I mean, we're hoping that it's a growth sector, but I know it's difficult to track.
Mm-hmm. Let me just move forward here. In fact, we're right on the service sector. Here's where we've done some work. We've taken a stab at exactly what is the value of these service sector exports. Our best guess is about $500 to $750 million annually, and that probably underestimates the total. The reason I can say that is one company alone a fairly well-known oil and gas field service company here in Alaska, alone was doing $250 million in annual sales overseas. So this is probably a conservative number. When we published this information in the in one of the local business magazines, I got a couple calls from people in these industries who said, "Greg, you're too low. It's probably higher than that." But we have Alaskan companies, for example, providing logistics for oil and gas field services, like over in Russia. We have companies that are installing air traffic control management systems overseas. We have companies involved in engineering, in construction, in a wide range of sectors, and I mentioned some of them here. And we also know where they're doing this business. These are some of the ones we know about: Canada, Russia, Taiwan, China, Korea, the Middle East. These are where Alaskan companies are getting business. Why Alaskan companies? Well, Alaskan companies have developed world-class capabilities and are now finding customers overseas. They've gained this experience and expertise in carrying out projects in remote locations with extended supply chain challenges, often in harsh weather or climatic conditions, under the strictest of environmental regimes, and often in a case where there may not be locally trained labor and it has to be brought in, or there's not locally available supplies and it has to be brought in. These type of skill sets, this experience, can be applied in other parts of the world, and increasingly it is. Alaskans have gotten very good at doing complex projects under difficult conditions and under the strictest of environmental regimes, and can do so successfully, and because of that, they're able to compete against the biggest and best around the world and get a piece of the action in some of these other markets. Another reason why Alaskan companies are able to succeed is that they've established relationships here with multinationals. Take a local a vendor that's doing business with BP here, for example. When BP does a project somewhere else, they know each other, and it's a good chance that they might be able to continue to do work for them somewhere else. And we see examples of this in a variety of industries. And to, I guess, my final slide, the trade outlook for 2009, we actually did this in January. Again, because of the nature of Alaska's commodities or exports, which are commodities, it's the prices of these things and the value of the seafood catch which will greatly determine our success. I just took a look. I just called and checked on the current price of zinc, our number one mineral export. Today, it's 51 cents a pound. A year ago, it was $1.10 a pound, and in January of 2007, it was $2 a pound. So these are very volatile. These prices can move up or down, and they do. So, you know, we're at 51 cents a pound for what we're getting out of Red Dog. That's what the world will pay us today. And that's down 50% from where it was just a year ago. So we have to watch what happens there. That will have a great, probably the major determinant in how well we'll do. So we're also looking at the effect of this U.S. slowdown to see how it's affecting Asia's exporting countries, many of which are our best customers. So how this crisis affects China will affect us. How it affects Korea and Japan and these other markets will affect us. Their ability to buy from us will be determined by how, to what extent, their economy is affected. Also watch the dollar. A weaker dollar helps us. A weaker dollar makes our exports appear cheaper, any dollar-based export, cheaper to the buyers overseas. So what's really good for us is we're dealing with a country that has a strong strong currency and a strong economy. That's like the ideal customer for us. This is now, it's the second year now, but, you know, we did lose about $300 million worth of exports with the Agrium closure. I don't know the fate, the ultimate fate of that plant. I believe it's just been mothballed for now. But that did impact our numbers by about $300 to $400 million per year. So overall, we're expecting exports to be down. We're looking, at least at this point, at them reaching about a $3.5 to $3.6 billion. Now this is down from the last year and the year before. But when you looked at that long 14-year chart, that's still relatively high historically from where we've been.
Greg, on that point, on the bullet point about the loss of fertilizer exports with Agrium, newspaper articles circulated across the state that our cost of fertilizer for the Greenbelt and Mat-Su, the Greenbelt and Delta, lawn and garden enthusiasts, that our cost for fertilizer were going to go up 400% here because we had lost Agrium. So my question for you is, does, although only a small fraction of what Alaska exports is value-added, to ask the question in reverse, do any of those value-added items return the availability in our marketplace without the cost of freight and transportation in the same way that Agrium's export of fertilizer made fertilizer available in Alaskans at an extraordinarily economical cost? Do any of our exports make a product available for Alaskans that brings down our cost of living or expands, you know, the market, the basket of goods that we buy? Kind of a reverse engineering question a little bit.
Yeah. Chairman Ramos, I guess to the extent that that we are doing value-added processing or manufacturing of our commodities, if we do it here, it should be, you know, it may be beneficial to Alaskans. It sounded like from what you said that they were getting a pretty good price on fertilizer, and now that those fertilizer production isn't here, they're paying a lot more. But for a lot of what we have to offer the world, the prices are set globally. Take an ounce of gold. Alaskans can't buy gold cheaper because it's mined here. I think the people who sell it are still going to want whatever the prevailing world price is for it. So some of those things, there may not be much room, if you will, for a cheaper price for Alaskans. But with some of the when and if there is value-added manufacturing or value-added processing for some of these things, you know, there should be some benefits, and it should be in some cases cheaper for us just because the fact it's here. Maybe you don't have to pay the shipping from somewhere else to get it here. There could be reasons why it would be cheaper here. One of the real challenges to any of the sort of value-added manufacturing that's been attempted here is the is getting the per unit cost down. In other words, manufacturing on a scale large enough to get the individual cost take a bottled water, to get that bottle to produce enough of them every day out of your plant to compete with someone even in Washington or somewhere that's maybe producing a million bottles a month and we're producing 100,000 bottles a month. Well, the cost is going to be higher because of that. So it's getting the volume. And the volume, because we have a small domestic market, Alaska itself is not a large enough market for a lot of these things. We're going to have to find markets outside of Alaska. And where we look in our world at World Trade Center and the international trade community here as a whole, we look to these overseas markets.
Thank you. Questions? Sarah McGuire?
Thank you. Greg, to that end, I think right away of cruise ships, and I know you and I have talked many times and worked in Penware on it, but what are our efforts there? I mean, you've essentially got global markets delivered right to you in your ports. What are we doing in Alaska with respect to marketing our products?
Madam Chair, there's been a number of, for example, you see a success with a company right here in Juneau. The Alaskan Brewing Company has had success in getting their value-added product onto Alaska Airlines flights. I've seen it there. From time to time, we've had some bottled water on some of those flights, different carriers. There's a couple opportunities potentially when you have a ship with 3,000 or 4,000 people on it. If they're coming to Alaska, it might be possible to get some Alaskan food and beverage products onto those ships to kind of add to the experience of coming to Alaska. You can have Budweiser beer anywhere, but how about the Alaskan beer while you're out in Alaskan waters cruising to the state? But another thing that it does, when those people are here and try our seafood, they try our products, they go back home and become potential new customers for us. So there's an opportunity for us to introduce what we have to offer, not just in our scenery and the experience of visiting our state, but in the products that we make. There's a chance for people to try them and become long-term customers. And we hope that's the case. We hope that they like what they try and go home and go to their favorite restaurant and say, hey, do you have that Alaskan halibut or do you have that Alaskan salmon? That's what I want.
And a final question. The Senate President and I live in beautiful communities. We don't live in Anchorage, as the other four members here do.
Eagle River.
ish.
Point of order.
Yeah.
Point of order.
You're on your own on this one.
I've been doing so well. Here's my question. Talk about the relevance of the Ted Stevens International Airport. Unique geography, globally competitive jet aviation prices. You touched on sitting in your condo, mm-hmm. seeing a Singapore jet airline take off. Mm-hmm. Would you talk about the strategic importance of the Ted Stevens Airport and the manners in which in the future we can exploit the fourth busiest cargo airport in the world?
Chairman Ramos, obviously the existence of the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport and in certain cases the Fairbanks International Airport as well, which has enjoyed cargo flights over the years. That connection does make possible the movement of high value, sort of the what moves by air tends to be a low weight and high value. Those are the types of things that people move by air. It does open the doors for us in terms of value-added manufacturing. If we are sort of moving up the food chain and start getting involved either in the distribution, I'm talking logistics here, global logistics, think of that we're equidistant to markets in Europe, Asia, and North America. We're almost exactly equidistant to those markets. If you're a company that sells products in all three markets, you could use Anchorage as sort of a warehousing sort of a staging area, also for repair and return operations. If you have a phone that isn't working and you're selling them in those three markets, you could send them to Anchorage for repair, sort of end of runway operations, and do it there. There's a lot of opportunities. That airport is an asset that can make possible a lot of good things for our community, not only moving cargo, but hopefully it will continue to grow its passenger operations, and I hope that we will be able to grow our international passenger operations. I would think, I've always felt that in terms of the tourism industry, an industry that you know very well, Mr. Chairman, that if a company, take a multinational company that has operations in Asia, Europe, and North America, they could all fly 7 hours and get to Alaska and have their conference here. Have their conference or their convention or their trade show here, and all of them save time by coming to the middle, coming to Alaska, in the case that you've mentioned, the Anchorage Airport. But while they're here, they can visit all parts of our state.
Thank you. As we close this meeting, to be presumptuous, if we can invite you back again, we might task you with the dual purpose the dual objectives of, one, surveying those four countries, and particular market segments in those four countries that we might pursue. And secondly, if you have the ability in that subsequent meeting with you, if you could talk about how we might better leverage the Ted Stevens International Airport, recognizing that as a key infrastructure asset of the state of Alaska. And it would be terrific to get a presentation to you on those two points. I think would be just marvelous, and we'll let you work with our staff and Chair McGuire's staff to find a time that works for both committees. But I just want to thank you very much. It's a great meeting today. Any closing comments from members?
That's very good.
If I could just I want to commend you, Chairman Ramirez, and you, Madam Chair McGuire, and members of the committee for your leadership in the areas of economic development, trade, tourism. These represent very, very important diversifications for our state, and the rewards can be significant. In the trade world, it's about $4 billion a year coming into our state. That's a number that can grow. Tourism is an area that can grow. We can grow economically through getting more value for all of our resources. Moving one step up, just one step up the food chain on our natural resources, and adding some value, adding one more stage of the processing here for a state of our size can pay enormous benefits and dividends. So I encourage, I guess I'm enthused by your committees being active, and I look forward to the opportunity to come back and working very closely with all of you. If there's any questions that you didn't get answered today, please contact me. We'll get back with you straight away. And look forward to seeing you on our next time that we come down here. And thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you. The privilege was ours. And at 6:30, and you can catch your cab, and we're adjourned.
Thank you.